This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll check in with Shasta County on California Governor Gavin Newsom's latest announcement that churches can now reopen. We'll also hear why it's important to follow your county's guidelines in order for them to keep moving forward with reopening, and we'll get a psychologist's take on why some people are following health recommendations like wearing masks during this pandemic and others are not. As always, if you have questions for us, let us know on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Tuesday, May 26th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, some news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. As businesses began reopening in earnest across much of California, the pandemic reached Lassen County, causing a major setback in what was the North State's last remaining coronavirus-free county. Three additional cases were confirmed following the discovery of the county's first case late Friday night. Officials there have restored restrictions only recently lifted, just as other counties lift them. On Tuesday, Lassen County Health Officer Kenneth Corver rescinded the county's roadmap for recovery for at least 7 days. This prohibits restaurants from anything other than curbside pickup and delivery, shutters salons, barbershops, and manicurists, along with disallowing in-store shopping at non-essential retail businesses. The order also forbids houses of worship from conducting services in person. Lassen County officials are attempting to retrace the movements of those who became infected. People who may have been in proximity with COVID-19 positive patients will be tested and ordered to quarantine themselves until results are available, and for a further 2 weeks if the result is positive. Authorities vow to swiftly reopen businesses if the situation stabilizes. In the North State, the number of cases jumped to 181 across the 11-county region after new cases were confirmed in 8 different counties over the holiday weekend. According to the most recent figures available, the caseload in Sutter County has reached 42, while positive cases in Butte County surged to 40, increasing by nearly a third since last week. The number of cases in Shasta County is 36, in Yuba County 28, Glenn County 12, Siskiyou 6, Colusa 5, Lassen and Plumas 4, Tehama 3, and Trinity County 1. Deaths attributed to the virus in the region remain at 8. Statewide, the virus continues spreading. Officials with the California Department of Public Health report 493 deaths from the virus in the past week, representing little change in recent days. The rate fatalities are increasing, however, appears to be moderating. Deaths are up 14% compared to last week. Last week, they were rising at a week-over-week rate of 17%. A total of 3,795 deaths in California are attributed to COVID-19. Officials reported 94,558 cases Monday, up 17% and 14,000 more cases than a week earlier. In a press conference Tuesday, while announcing the lifting of restrictions, Governor Gavin Newsom called on the public at large to continue precautions to protect seniors.
Our elderly, those with compromised immune systems, others are in categories of very, very high risk. And as we go back to some semblance of normalcy with modifications, let us not forget the most vulnerable amongst us that are continuing to be vulnerable to this disease.
State education officials will discuss plans and possible hurdles regarding the reopening of public schools Wednesday. Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond is expected to outline guidelines being developed for local districts on how to resume classes safely. Thurmond is also expected to discuss virtual teaching and connectivity issues in rural areas. Barbershops and salons can reopen across much of the state, but the experience will be quite different. Barbers and stylists and their clients are required to wear masks throughout all appointments. Services that can't be done while a client is wearing a mask, such as shaving, facial waxing, threading, and facial treatments, remain prohibited, according to state public health officials. Nail salons remain closed for the same reason. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. California Governor Gavin Newsom had some big announcements for the state on Tuesday. Hair salons and barbershops can reopen with modifications in California counties that have approval from the state and have already okayed shopping centers and restaurants to reopen. And religious services also got the green light, but under new guidelines, the most significant being how many people can attend a service. The new rules state that places of worship must limit the number of people attending a service to 25% of normal, or no more than 100 people, whichever of those is fewer. The shift comes after President Donald Trump implored states to allow religious services. Earlier this month, a letter was sent to the governor with 1,200 signatures from California faith leaders asking that worshiping be made an essential service. NSPR's Mark Albert recently caught up with Carrie Schutte, spokesperson for the Shasta County Health and Human Services Agency, to see what the change means for the county and residents there. One of the first things Mark asked was how the community is feeling about the announcement.
We are hearing that folks are happy to be able to get back to their churches. It's looking a little bit different than it has the last time they were in church, but I think people are generally seeing it as one step forward.
As businesses reopen and we reach stage three and a lot of restrictions have dropped, I imagine that people are feeling that wearing a mask isn't that important anymore. Is that something that you're seeing in the community, and what words of wisdom might you have?
Masks are still a really important piece of us being able to move forward in our recovery. The virus is still here. It hasn't gone anywhere. And we are strongly encouraging people to wear masks in addition to the practices that they're already using, such as social distancing, frequent hand washing, all of those sorts of things. That mask is an added layer of protection to keep that virus from spreading in our community. In the past 2 weeks, we've had 3 cases of people who were asymptomatic. So those people have been potentially spreading the virus in our community without knowing it because they were not sick.
So they had absolutely no symptoms. They were going about their business, and other people who may have contacted them, as you're saying?
So we have the testing at Shasta College, the state-sponsored testing through OptumServe, for people who do not have symptoms. And we've been encouraging people to take advantage of that, particularly people who are out and about working in essential businesses and now working in other businesses, just to make sure that they are not carriers of COVID-19. And in fact, there were 3 who tested positive and had no symptoms at all. So if they were, you know, out and about and happened to cough or sneeze and someone were around them, they would probably think nothing of it because they were not symptomatic. But in fact, they certainly could have been spreading it during that time.
What kind of contact tracing have you been able to conduct?
Since before COVID, actually, the public health department uses contact tracing as a regular tool in its toolbox and always has for decades. At least that's the practice here at Shasta County Public Health. As soon as we get a positive test result, we begin contact tracing immediately. We interview the patient and determine who those close contacts might be, and then we deliver quarantine orders to them.
About how many people is that affected, do you know?
We have 18 people on quarantine right now, and we have 4 in isolation. So isolation is for people who have tested positive. So those 18 people on quarantine would have been people who had contact with one of those 4 people.
I know that, like authorities throughout the rest of California and probably throughout the nation, are really taking an educational rather than a punitive approach. I'm assuming that that's still the case. If authorities see people kind of flagrantly violating the precautions or the guidelines, they'll be advised that they're making an error, but really nothing will come of that.
Right. We are hopeful that people in our community, business owners and patrons alike, take very seriously the fact that there are modifications that are required to be in place for businesses to reopen. That includes following the guidance and the checklists that have been provided by the state of California through the governor's office. We're encouraging business owners to share those completed checklists with their staff so their staff are fully aware of what the modifications are and what they require. We're also encouraging customers like you and me to familiarize themselves with some of the standard things that businesses are supposed to be doing so that when they go into a business, they can feel that they are safe and protected as much as possible. Like I said, the virus has not gone anywhere. And as we start to open these different types of businesses, including churches and hair salons and places like that, that people really, really understand that it's incumbent upon all of us to protect ourselves and to protect each other. That is how we keep moving forward. If we end up with a bunch of outbreaks and a bunch of very sick people and our hospitals start to become overwhelmed, we have to move backwards. And nobody wants that. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for our health. There is nothing good about going backwards. So for those who are not taking it seriously, we strongly encourage you to really think about the impact that even one person can have on the situation we're in right now.
Things are sort of left necessarily vague, but the discussion or the trigger for reinstating more stringent regulations and restrictions is sort of vague. And there was in the affestation, it referred to a significant increase in cases. Has there been any discussion or development as to putting some meat on that bone? What significant would mean in that context?
Absolutely. We definitely do need to have specifics, and we're working on those plans right now.
That was Carrie Schutte, spokesperson for the Shasta County Health and Human Services Agency, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. As you just heard Carrie Schutte say, there's nothing good about going backward when it comes to reopening, and every one of us has an impact on the situation we're in right now. So why do some of us choose to follow public health guidelines and others don't? We're about to take a break, but we'll be asking that question to a psychologist when we return. This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. A lot of people are following their local public health guidelines, but there's no doubt that some are not. And choosing to wear a mask or choosing not to wear a mask is starting to become somewhat of a controversy. When you go out to the grocery store or other businesses, there is a wide discrepancy of people wearing or not wearing face coverings. NSPR's Matt Fidler wanted to get into the psychology of why some people are more concerned about the virus and choose to comply with the guidance of public health experts, and why some people are not, despite the known risks. To learn more, he called up Chico-based psychologist and author of Show Your Anxiety Who's Boss, Dr. Joel Minden.
People evaluate the degree of risk, and so if they believe that it's very unlikely that they're going to get sick or that they'll spread the virus, then certainly they'll, you know, the likelihood that they'll kind of engage in behaviors consistent with the belief that it's unlikely that something bad will happen increases. So I think that's you know, a really important factor. If someone doesn't really believe that they're in danger, that other people are in danger, or that perhaps the degree of risk has been overstated, then they're probably not going to work so hard to modify their behavior, because maybe another consideration is, this is kind of a hassle for me. I have to change my life dramatically to maintain distance, to stay at home, to wear this mask. And if it's unlikely that other people will be affected by my behavior, if I don't need to be this cautious, then I'm just not going to do it. So some people may kind of evaluate that degree of risk based on what they hear from media, from public figures. And certainly we've all heard, you know, these messages that if you're within a certain age range, or if you're healthy, that you're unlikely to develop significant symptoms that may result in serious medical complications. And so some people look at that information and then kind of assume that I really don't have too much to worry about. And then some people are very emotion driven, and they kind of reflect on the fact that this is uncomfortable to have to modify lifestyle to comply with some of these recommendations. Then they may work hard to sort of reduce the discomfort that comes with following some of these social distancing guidelines.
Do you think there's something to do with short-term versus long-term risks? Like maybe a person that is less likely to want to wear a mask is also more likely to engage in, I don't know, other risky long-term behaviors.
I think so. People, you know, often the decisions we make about personal behavior is highly influenced by the immediate consequence. So if you smoke cigarettes, you might say, well, this helps me manage stress, or it helps me relax. And maybe the long-term degree of risk is not as apparent. Maybe we don't see the data in our own lives that would suggest that this is dangerous. This is something that I want to maybe consider carefully before deciding how to act. You know, for example, driving fast, right? We might say, well, that's, you know, it's kind of exciting and I need to get somewhere and that's the important thing. And, you know, maybe less focused on the possibility that, you know, you get into an accident or get a speeding ticket. So I think that's pretty typical for a lot of people to be very aware of the immediate consequences of their actions. And sometimes the long-term effects maybe don't stand out so much, or maybe the degree of risk seems minimal because perhaps of an inability to take in the data or...
Well, taking in the data, if you don't mind me interrupting, that's kind of interesting, because with something like drinking and driving, which I think was a lot more common 50 years ago, like anecdotes from my parents who are baby boomer generation said that their friends drove drunk a lot. And it wasn't really until a campaign like Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the 80s and 90s where it brought a lot of stigma to it. And people don't brag about driving drunk anymore, even if sometimes people still do drive drunk. There's certainly a lot more enforcement of it too. So it does seem like there are ways to change this behavior, and especially around long-term risks.
Absolutely. And I think that there are two different things happening here. We have to consider the social context and the power of social influences to shape behavior. And so if we get consistent media messages, or, you know, if law enforcement is responding to certain problem behaviors, and if we see that the people that we care about, the people we look up to, that we admire, that they're sort of pushing this idea publicly, we're much more likely to comply with those guidelines that might be more important to consider or to adhere to long term. On the other hand, privately, we may maintain certain beliefs that this is unnecessary for me, that this creates an inconvenience in my own life, and I'm only doing this because the social pressures are so great. And the potential consequences, if I don't follow these expectations, and the consequences might be judgment from others or some sort of penalty, those consequences might be enough for me to sort of comply with those expectations or those guidelines publicly, but privately I might maintain a certain belief that this is unnecessary, and I really wish I could just do things the way I want to do them.
So one of the things that's been reported on this program, especially in the last 2 weeks or so, is that companies that seem to be breaking the social distancing rules, while they're getting warnings in our area in the North State here, they don't seem to be getting any fines or any punishment. There doesn't seem to be an enforcement. How can that affect how people feel about the rules in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I guess if the legal consequences are so minor that, there's really no incentive for people to modify their behavior other than the possibility that they may be judged harshly by others, then certainly that's going to strengthen the belief that it really isn't that important for me to follow these social distancing guidelines or other things that we're hearing about to remain safe or keep other people safe. The priority will be, what do I want to do or what do I think is best?
Is there a difference between how decisions are made before a disaster compared to in the middle of a disaster? You know, preparing for something compared to reacting. And I wonder if maybe part of the discrepancy between the reactions of people in our own community have something to do with that this is just kind of a panic situation. And we haven't really been prepared for this. You know, I've done earthquake drills. I've done fire drills. I've never done a pandemic drill before.
Mm-hmm. Well, people are being presented with a lot of unknowns. So that makes it much more difficult to make effective decisions when it's really hard to know who do I trust or what do I prioritize or what's likely to happen and what's the emotional aspect of all of this. So I think when there's a lot of confusion, when we're dealing with a crisis, when there's ambiguity, people are much more likely to draw from, they're much more likely to rely on different data to draw a conclusion and to make a decision about how to act. And I think one way to sort of, think about decision making is some people tend to be really emotion driven in the choices that they make. And so perhaps, their thinking is so heavily influenced by, as you mentioned before, the immediate consequences of their actions or inaction. And so some people might be really drawn to, the fear that comes with, getting sick or not having a job or not being able to pay the bills or being isolated from other people. And so the emotional element is really going to stand out to them because they're not really sure what's factual. What do we really know? What's the best way to proceed logically? So the emotional element stands out so much, and they tend to be sort of attracted to maybe ideas that will help them reduce the intensity of a difficult emotion or make them feel better. So sometimes the decision-making is very emotion-driven. It may not be entirely logical. On the other hand, some people are very motivated to collect information that will help them make appropriate decisions that will benefit them not just in the short term, but that will have a lasting long-term impact that's desirable as well. And I think, these are the folks who are presented with a crisis, with ambiguity, and they're much more likely to attend to information, to data. They're much more likely to consider the issue from a variety of perspectives. And maybe they're less driven by the emotional element that comes up in situations like this. So really do see some interesting differences in personality and the way people approach situations like this. And so, I think that's one explanation for why we see variability in the way people respond.
You have a book called Show Your Anxiety Who's Boss. We all feel a lot of anxiety because we don't know the future right now. Does anxiety hurt our ability to make rational decisions, especially important ones like this?
Absolutely. With anxiety, we tend to get overwhelmed by certain beliefs that can be quite biased. They may not be entirely data driven by data. In this case, I mean, factual information. So with anxiety, right, we're dealing sort of with the what ifs, and often the beliefs that we have when we're anxious, they're biased, they're excessively negative, they overestimate the degree of risk, they underestimate our ability to cope. And When we are aware of those beliefs, when we become invested in them, when we believe those ideas are real, that they're factual, then of course we're going to experience that emotional consequence that feels so much like fear, and then we're going to scramble to do something so we don't have to feel that way, or so that we can address a practical problem, like in this case, you know, modifying behavior to make sure that we keep safe or to bring in a steady income.
I'm interested in the group mentality of wearing masks. For a little while, it seems like you go out and everyone's wearing masks. People are not so much anymore, even though I think we actually have greater potential for an outbreak in our area than we have during this whole pandemic now. And I'm wondering, have you seen a stigma? I felt a stigma wearing a mask in certain locations. And I'm wondering if there's a psychological phenomenon where if you see other people wearing masks or not wearing masks, and if that's going to affect your behavior, kind of a peer pressure thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, such an important issue because we've got sort of the private beliefs that people have, and then we have the public behavior that we can observe directly. People may not agree with the idea that it's important to wear masks or maintain distance, but you know, the scientists are telling us that this is something that we need to do or that we should do. And so the important thing here is not getting people to believe that this is an important behavior or pattern of behavior to display, but rather just to get them to change their behavior. So I think if we're in a context in which people are not following these guidelines, then of course I think it's natural for people to wonder whether you know, maybe the risk isn't so great. Maybe this isn't something I need to do. And if I don't wear a mask or if I get close to other people, it looks like in this context, nobody's going to have an issue with it. So since that's easier for me, it's more comfortable, since it maybe fits with my view that maybe scientists are overstating the risk, then, you know, I'm not going to wear the mask. I'm going to interact with people in public places and not be terribly concerned with this. On the other hand, right, if we're in an environment in which there are signs posted or employees at a store or restaurant are wearing masks, and we're kind of getting those messages, not just, you know, in terms of printed materials, but sort of behavioral or social messages. We see the behavior of other people. Everyone's wearing the mask. Everyone's maintaining distance. We're much less likely to go against these, you know, these social norms that we observe, because certainly we don't want to deal with that, the social consequence of being criticized by other people, judged harshly in some way. So I think it really is important, if we're trying to get people to change their behavior, it's really important to find a way to establish social norms in public context so that people are more likely to comply with these guidelines that are really going to keep us safe in the long term.
That was Dr. Joel Minden, psychologist and author of Show Your Anxiety Who's Boss, speaking with NSPR's Matt Fidler. And that is your program. If you have questions, give us a call on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30, or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to North State Public Radio.